I'm going to call this meeting of the House Finance Committee to order. Let the record reflect that the time is currently 1:35 p.m. on Friday, April 19th, 2024. And present today, we have Representative Josephson, Representative Hannon, Representative Galvin, Representative Stapp, Co-Chair Representative Edgman, Representative Tomaszewski is online, Representative, Kronk, Representative Ortiz, Representative Co-Chair Johnson is also online. Also online, we have Representative Colomb and myself, Co-Chair Foster. So it looks like we have everyone here. And so with that, just a reminder, if folks can mute their cell phones. And we have two bills that will be taken up this afternoon. The first is House Bill 74, which is geothermal resources. This is the first hearing of the bill, and so we'll hear the introduction, and then we'll set the bill aside. The next bill we'll be hearing is HB 388, so that is the Cook Inlet Reserve-based lending bill, and that's an introductory hearing as well. So we'll hear from the sponsor, set that aside. For the folks online, Representative Colomb, Representative Tomaszewski, and Representative Johnson, if you have any questions, feel free to either chime in over the phone lines, or I'll be monitoring my phone if you wanted to send a text and just let me know that you've got a question. So first up, we have House Bill 74, that's geothermal resources, and I'll ask Sean Clifton from the Division of Oil and Gas, as well as Deputy Commissioner John Crother, to please come to the table, put yourselves on the record, and we also have online Melanie Weirden, the Director of the Division of Geological and Geophysical Surveys, as well as Brett Huber, Chairman of the Alaska Oil and Gas Conservation Commission. So with that, thank you very much for being here, Deputy Commissioner Crother, and looks like a new face for me anyway, Sean Clifton, if you could both put yourself on the record.
Yes. For the record, I am Sean Clifton, the Division of Oil and Gas.
And John Crother, Deputy Commissioner, DNR.
Take it away. We're discussing HB 74, and first, we will have the director of the Division of Geological and Geophysical Surveys talk a little bit about the fundamentals of geothermal, and then we'll move into the bill.
And is that Mr. Brett Huber?
Director Worden.
Oh, okay. Director Worden, if you can put yourself on the record.
Hello. For the record, my name is Melanie Worden, Director, Department of Natural Resources, Division of Geological and Geophysical Surveys. And we'll just do a very quick overview of the fundamentals of geothermal systems here. If we can go to slide number 3.
We're on slide 3.
The fundamental ingredients of a usable geothermal energy system is that you have an elevated geothermal gradient. You have porosity and permeability for the migration of these fluids. You have surface access to the land, that you have a sufficiently large thermal system, and that you have customers for this energy. Slide 4, please. As you can see in this figure of heat flow in Alaska, most of Alaska is thought to have a slightly elevated heat flow, shown in red. However, only very localized areas in these red areas have all the ingredients for cost-effective geothermal energy use. Slide number 5, please. Geothermal heat, where technically and economically accessible, is an excellent form of sustainable energy. Hydrothermal systems with fluids are the most common form of energy extraction from geothermal heat. Complex geologic parameters are necessary for a viable geothermal resource. All present at one location is rare. Alaska contains many potential geothermal resource areas, and new technologies that will expand geothermal development into less favorable geology are also on the horizon. And finally, slide number 6, there's a fiscal note attached to this geothermal bill, and it was included for $1 million in the FY25 governor's amended budget. It will enable DGGS, or Division of Geological Geophysical Surveys, to restart our geothermal program. And this will provide information to support DNR's geothermal leasing program to help identify lands to lease. And it will attract explorers and developers of Alaska's geothermal resources. We'll conduct the work listed here. We will also use this work to attract federal funds to help characterize Alaska's geothermal systems. And it's complementary with the initiatives that are different, complementary to those of the university and federal, state, and native and private sector partners. And that's all for this presentation.
Okay, we've got a question from Representative Hannon and then Galvin.
Thank you, Chair Foster. Through the chair, Director Worden, you used the verb restart the geothermal programs. So could you tell me what we're restarting, how many staff, is the million for one fiscal year of new staffing to, as you use, restart a program, or are there ongoing employees that move into this restart?
Okay, through the chair, to answer the question, back in the 1980s, we had a program, and we have many more modern techniques which we can apply to this, and so that's why we're proposing to restart this. For staffing, we have no staff on board with geothermal expertise, and so we would be proposing to hire 3 staff to run this program. And was there another part to this question?
The clarification?
Representative Hannon.
Through the chair. That $1 million, is that 1 year of operating for the 3 new staff, or is that capital that you need? Or just tell me a little bit more about the budget to have this functional program.
Okay. Through the chair, to answer the question, it calls for 3 permanent staff, and that's $400,000. There's $10,000 for travel. There's $550,000 for services that we contract out for services to obtain the data, and a small amount, $40,000 for commodities. And this is in the governor's FY25 operating budget, and it would be an annual request.
Okay. And then
ongoing.
Representative Hannon.
Could you, through the chair, what in a sort of, I guess, not the most optimistic, but in an optimistic scenario when we stand this up, what would be the length of time that we anticipate before we would start to see some geothermal energy production going on in Alaska? Is that a 20 years out, or is that a 10 years out kind of scenario? If we're going to restart something, I want to make sure we're clear about we need to be making a commitment to see it through, and how long is it going to take us to see it through to production of energy in places?
Okay, through the chair, to answer the question, For our program, we are creating the data that industry needs to know that Alaska has geothermal potential and to attract them to come here and invest. And so I am unfamiliar with the timelines, how long it would take to get through the permitting process. And so that's beyond what I'm able to answer there.
Deputy Commissioner Crother?
Yeah, Representative Hannon, through the chair. I think in terms of output from the geothermal program, we'd start to see results within the next year or two. But as Director Worden mentioned, that's a very front end of the kind of initial resource information that then a company would have to take and undergo exploration. And so that would be a multi-year process potentially. And then even on a successful scenario, it would be several years out before we'd have kind of a project concept that would start to be formed. I would note one of the core purposes of the legislation as opposed to the budget increment, although we think both are important for the long-term success of geothermal in Alaska, the legislation is about making our kind of leasing and development terms more attractive and workable for operators. So that's at that kind of project development or taking exploration into a project concept and development phase. And so we think that the bill improves that. And we do have two active exploration licenses that I think one of them is now moved into a lease posture. But we think this legislation would help at that phase as well. And the goal of that lease is to develop a project within, you know, sooner the better from their perspective. It may take several years of on-site visits and then several additional years of project development. But that's the general time frame.
We're starting to get into the real nuts and bolts of the bill, but we haven't heard the bill section part yet. So maybe if we could continue on with the presentation and I think, Mr. Clifton, you've got the next section on the bill?
I do.
Okay. For the record, I'm Sean Clifton, Policy and Program Specialist with the Division of Oil and Gas. Before the hearing, Representative Jessison correctly pointed out that many of you have seen this bill before in largely the same form, but there are a few differences, and I will point that out for those that may remember it. The purpose of this legislation is to modernize DNR's and Alaska's geothermal exploration program. We want to make things more attractive and increase the potential for getting some geothermal development on state lands. This bill does not change anything for federal lands or private lands or native lands, just state lands. And we are wanting to promote the energy industry. As we have been talking about a lot this session, we know that we have some significant energy concerns in the near future, and this can be a component of that solution for Alaska. We are aligning our geothermal program with the oil and gas exploration license program that we've already had for over two decades, the Division of Oil and Gas. We think it's a good program. It's been working for us, and we are now giving some attention to the geothermal program since we have had some interest in that recently. And one of the main obstacles is how short the term is for our permits and the very high bar for converting those permits into leases for long-term development. So we have a short list of main things that we want to do, but really the crux of it is we are making our geothermal program more modern, lessons learned from the oil and gas program, and we've been able to develop that in components of the bill in concert with feedback from our geothermal industry. Any questions?
Yes.
Is it on the slide? Okay, Representative. We actually have a lineup. So we've got Representative Galvin, but it might have been some other questions. Representative Edgman was next, and then Representative Josephson. Representative Edgman, did you have a?
Yeah, I just want to get some. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just want to get some clarification. There was a couple of items that were funded through the Renewable Energy Grant Program. Last year, one of them was Mount Spur. I think the other was. Can't remember what the other one was, but can you just sort of weave that into this page?
Yes, through the chair, Representative Edgman. If I recall correctly, the grants through the renewable grant program, I apologize, I forget the specific nomenclature of that program, but I believe that they were doing feasibility studies for running power lines to these potential projects. And we'll get more into this later in the presentation, but we've got two project areas with active permits and leases right now. One is at Mount Spur, and the other is on Augustine Island, which is a volcanic island.
Okay, just a quick follow-up. There was mentioned a moment ago that this $1 million would actually help staff up this geothermal program. So you must have had, it's interesting because the Renewable Energy Grant Fund program that went through last year was funded at $15 million, at the very top of those list were those two geothermal projects. I think there were two and three, if I remember correctly, no matter. But it was interesting to see that they were so high on the list, or to look back that they were high on the list. And I remember seeing in the paper the RFPs or whatever that went out to get those services. And so there's been some work in the Department of Geothermal analysis, just not the work that this bill proposes to do. And that's kind of the clarification I wanted to get to.
Okay. Representative Josephson? Oh, did you, were you wanting any comments?
No, okay.
Thanks. Representative Josephson?
Yes. Director, or specialist, I guess, could you describe the fourth bullet? Can you paint me a picture? Or illustrate how that would look.
About the rental and royalty modification?
Okay.
Through the chair, Representative Josephson. So in the statute now, there is an opportunity after 20 years of production for the commissioner or director to renegotiate rentals and royalties. And if it's a particularly... Yeah, I mean, the language in it, in the statute is broad enough that you could read it as being revised upwards. If it's looking like a particularly successful project and they're making a bunch of money, we could triple their rent or something like that. And one of our lessees was, you know, pointed that out as being a significant obstacle to getting long-term financing. You know, how do we get 30-year financing for a project if 20 years down the road, the economics are going to change significantly. So that is why we introduced that into this bill. And that is one of the main changes from the last form that you saw 2 years ago.
Beautifully explained.
Okay. Representative, got Representative Galvin, then Hannon.
Thank you, Co-Chair Foster. Through the chair, I had a couple of questions that are more general. Given that this topic is new to me, one is I note that it seems as though this is a newer market that we haven't yet been in the field with yet, and I know that we have some examples of private industry doing well. I know North Fairbanks, for example, but it seems like with renewable energy projects, including this, but I may be very wrong, that the transmission is the biggest question mark, like getting it to market. And so I wondered if it's possible that we might have the cart before the horse here. Should we be first working on making sure we can get it to market, or does it make sense that we need to have this lead time in geothermal? And I think likely it would make sense to hear from Deputy Commissioner on that.
Yeah. Thank you, Representative Galvin. John Crowther for the record, and through the chair. I think in very quick summary, you're absolutely right that transmission and access to markets are critical for these projects to go forward, in part because they may be located by nature of their kind of geologic constraints, you know, high volcanic activity, a community may locate far from them, and so getting an energy source to the community is critical. But we also believe, you know, for one of these projects to be successful, they have to have the front-end information that our Division of Geological and Geophysical Surveys can support with. They have to have the project and licensing terms to do the exploration, to develop a project. They have to have the flexibility to actually bring that into development, including at that step having transmission developed as well. So we think we have to work on this part for them to have confidence that they can get that part together to make transmission worthwhile to investigate and pursue and permit. And so it's an all kind of have to pursue them all at once.
Okay, thank you. If I may follow up. So in looking at, again, the global picture of putting together a package to make Alaskan projects look attractive, the idea here is that we get good data on these particular areas, and you need to expand. It sounds like the opportunity in terms of geographically, you need more acres to do that, and you want more time, and or you think that more time would make us more attractive, I should say. And then gets the other more global question is, if we're making Alaska look attractive to outside companies, is the overall goal then to potentially export energy, or are we trying to have opportunities for Alaskans to have lower cost and reliable energy?
Yeah. Thank you, Representative Galvin. John Crowther through the chair. I think in very short response, the very exciting potential of geothermal has always been the renewable, low cost, you know, sustainable long-term element of it. But there's some evolution in the energy and demand markets that's making it much more potentially developable. And so core to the department's interests are the production of the resource, but also, of course, the energy security benefits for in-state use. You know, mm-hmm. long-term renewable power at low rates is what is a huge boon to the economy and the consumer and residents of Alaska. Geothermal is getting a lot more interest, I think, on a global scale, because there's now diverse and diffuse uses of power. You know, if you're generating power remotely, there's new applications, technologies that can be a consumer and demand for that power, spread out the capital cost, and so have the in-state consumer benefit and potentially have value-added products generated. So that's a very new space for the energy markets generally, which is making kind of bringing focus to geothermal. This bill is not meant to enable every step of the different kind of processes that would be necessary for those kind of projects to be developed. We think some of those are already in place. Some of the things like transmission are big efforts that would be required as well. But this bill sets the stage for the underlying resource to be identified, explored, and set up for development.
Through the chair, if I may, one last follow-up then. Okay, that makes real good sense to me. As you're comparing it to oil and gas and the marketability of oil and gas, I know that, for example, that field, that niche, has a very well-established kind of program. You as the Department of Natural Resources, has a very good sense of what that companies intend to do in terms of their marketing, how their whole plan of operations is very clear. You have a good set of timelines to know what how much the companies are going to spend within the state and what they plan to do, how they're going to make revenue, and how the state will make revenue in addition to that. So it sounds like looking ahead, we have hopefully a lot of work for us to get a bill that also tightens up, making sure that Alaskans can reap benefits not only by enjoying lower, cleaner energy, but also potentially setting us up for some marketing that will help us long-term as a community to potentially attract other businesses looking for low rates of energy. So I'm excited to hear that more global thinking, and hopefully this will be leading to that. Thank you.
Okay. We've got a question from Representative Hannon, and then after that, maybe we might have you kind of go through the entire presentation. Just for me, I'd like to have kind of the foundation built before we start kind of talking about things in general. So we'll go to Representative Hannon, and then if we could round out the presentation. So Representative Hannon.
Thank you, Chair Foster. I want to return to the bullet point that Representative Joson asked a question about, and that's the language is in Section 7, repealing the 20-year royalty. And I want to know that if that aligns with what we currently do for oil and gas exploration licenses.
We don't.
Mr. Clifton?
Yes. This is Sean Clifton, through the chair, Representative Hannon. We don't have anything like that in our oil and gas statutes. I'm not going to go too deep into it, but it's not generally interpreted in our royalty modification statutes that we can revise them upwards, only downwards. But the language in the geothermal statute is a little bit confusing and suggestive, and that's why we want to clean it up, because it appears to be a risk.
Representative Hannon, through the chair, John Crowther here. I just would note for the committee, we don't really believe that language today is functional. It says the commissioner can renegotiate. Renegotiation is inherently a mutual activity, and you know that there's not. It implies some sort of authority to compel, but there's not a further statutory mechanism to do that. So, were we to see one of these projects develop, we're not really sure that this provision in law means anything. But it is being identified by financiers as a disincentive.
Representative Hannon?
Chair Foster, one follow-up. The bill's presented as trying to match this to oil and gas, and I know that we have some royalty modification language we use in our oil and gas. So I am curious why we're choosing to repeal this section entirely but not replace it with the corollary oil and gas. Because to me, if we're trying to align them, even if we know this doesn't mean upward, it means downward, versus no modifications can ever be made.
Representative,
for some consistency in that. But.
Yeah, Representative Hannon, through the chair, I very much understand the point, and sorry if we weren't clear. We view this as a different kind of provision than the current authority in a separate statutory section for modifying oil and gas royalties. There's some differences with how the project proceed, but I think the legislation makes the general framework very consistent, and questions of if we needed further authority to reduce royalties haven't come to us yet from the market, but were we to get projects up and going, that discussion might come. But I very much see your point, and sorry for the confusion there.
Thank you.
Okay. Mr. Clifton.
This is Sean Clifton for the record. And just real quick, we're going to go over our geothermal leasing history that DNR has, and it all fits onto one slide, which is amazing. There was a few lease sales, and then a little bit more recently, we've actually had what we would consider the same as exploration licenses, where we've had people apply for permits. Unfortunately, though, the permits are only good for 2 years, and then we have to they have a very high bar to meet in order to convert those into leases. And so that's why I'm noting the expiration dates here. For our Augustine permit, that's going to expire at the end of August. So passing this legislation is of keen interest to a few parties. And then, of course, the Mount Spur has seen the most activity by far, and there was even wells drilled out there back in after the 2008, but they basically ran out of time to find the right resource in order to invest in full development. But clearly, it's a volcano. It's still somewhat active, so we know that there's plenty of heat there. They just didn't find it, and so hopefully our current permittees will find something there. All right. The way it works now under the current law is we get an application for a permit. If there are no competing proposals, then they get their 2-year permit. If there are competing proposals, then we have to hold a lease sale. This bill changes that 2-year permit scenario to a 5-year license. And that, by the way, is the – when we're talking about the similarities between our oil and gas program, we're talking about the land management and resource disposal aspect of it. To the extent that there are any similarities between oil and gas and geothermal – there are wells, there's some production and injection, but beyond that, you can't put energy into barrels and transport it to faraway places. There's no broad market for it. Basically, you need to connect it to power lines, and so you're limited in that way. And that is why the royalty provisions are also quite different. As a note down here at the bottom, it's just a percentage of gross revenue because there's no barrels to measure or anything like that. both processes do require a best interest finding, and it's a very public process. We're not changing any aspect of that. There will still continue to be public processes, and it's transparent. It is an opportunity for public input as well as for input from the industry. Are there any questions?
If we could maybe get through the presentation.
Yeah. I'm moving much too slow. Yes. This is my attempt to summarize the whole bill succinctly onto one slide. I'm not going to read off this slide, but the members of the committee may find it helpful as a reference when reviewing the legislation. The highlights here is in sections 3 through 6, where we are just changing the terminology from permit to license. One of the main reasons for that is just the terminology is different from how it's currently used. And so we issue permits for surface activity, for surface uses, roads, pipelines, power lines, facilities, whereas our licenses are the pathway to a lease for the subsurface resource. I believe I've already covered all of this. The private use exemption, we have gotten a lot of feedback, and we've discussed this quite a bit in the various forms of this legislation over the years, is we want to allow and encourage private use that's not commercial. And so for some folks that are using geothermal, maybe just to heat the water in their house or warm it up a bit, or potentially to generate power for their house, that is the sort of scenario that we don't want to get away in the way of and have DNR regulating and issuing leases and charging rentals and whatnot. But we do want to encourage also general use of clean energy and characterizing the state's resources. So if it were to become commercial, if there were a sale, then that would be a different animal, and the DNR would have to get involved at that point. All right. Here is an example of commercial versus not commercial. The big thing, the big picture on the left, you've got injection wells, you've got production wells, you've got surface facilities, you've got turbines. It's very, very expensive. It takes a lot of staff to manage. Not the sort of thing that a typical homeowner would be getting involved in. So in some jurisdictions, the examples on the right that homeowners do, these examples are actively in use in lots of places in Alaska. There's been a research program at UAF for several years on the effectiveness of these kinds of systems in cold climates. But the sorts of systems on the right don't generally produce enough energy in order to generate power to produce anything that you could sell. And so that's where the main difference is. All right. One of the things that we've discussed quite a bit on this is the preferential rights provision that's in the statute. We also some of our industry partners have identified this as another potential hurdle to investment if surface owners can invoke a preference right to the state's resources if they hear about a developer working on a project. And so they have an opportunity once they get notice about the permit or lease to carve their land out of that permit or lease and then either develop it or not, or the questions about what might occur there are seen as a hurdle, and so that is why that's included in this bill.
Yep. Okay.
I will move on to the next slide unless there are questions on this. Okay. All right, and this is our terms and work commitment language. So like I said before, we're moving from 2 to 5 years, and then the conversion right now has a very high bar. We are lowering that bar from proving a commercial resource to merely meeting a work commitment, which is what we already do in the oil and gas side of the business. And we've discussed the rest of this already. All right. Another highlight of the bill is that we are increasing the maximum acreage that can be held, roughly doubling it. And the reason for that is geothermal systems can typically encompass a pretty broad area. I think like Mount Spur, we know that there's a volcano there. We know that there's hot stuff there. But after some drilling, they didn't find anything hot enough. They need more acreage and more time in order to properly characterize the resource and find something that is commercially viable. And then we're also proposing to do our rental fees in regulation instead of statute so that we can revise them more nimbly. Here are our geothermal resources and geothermal fluid definition. These are new, and I did not put the old definitions on there because there's no way that would all fit on the slide, but we consulted several different states to see how they've been updating their definitions. We got a lot of input from DGGS, and this is what we came up with. And one of the main points of it is that we are getting rid of the temperature limitation. Right now it is 120 degrees Celsius in the statute. Anything cooler than that would not count as a geothermal resource under a strict reading of the statute. And so that may have been appropriate way back when that law was first written, but it doesn't seem to make sense anymore. Everybody knows about Chena Hot Springs. They're producing power from roughly 80 degrees C. And it's potentially it's potentially viable to take even cooler temperature resources and produce commercial power from them. And so, especially as technology improves. So having an arbitrary temperature limitation in there doesn't make very much sense to us. So. Any questions?
One more slide.
Okay, yes. and then something that, honestly, when we were first writing this bill years ago, we did not anticipate coming up a lot, but has gotten a lot of attention, is the potential for extracting minerals or even non-hydrocarbon gases from the produced geothermal fluid. And it turns out that is actually a practical thing. Some of the technologies are not quite there yet for doing it in a cold climate. And you do have to locate, you know, what you're looking for and evaluate how much you're able to invest in that equipment in order to make it happen. But it is possible. And so we have worked through how we think it would work if such a, you know, if a geothermal well turned out to have valuable minerals or gases that could be produced from it. And then here's a reminder here of also what the royalty rate is and how that works. Okay.
Thank you very much.
We made it.
Okay. Going back to questions again, just anyone online, if you have any questions, feel free to chime in or shoot me a text and I'll put you in the queue. So with that, we've got a couple questions here. I'm going to go from left to right here. Representative Galvin, Hannon, and Josephson. Representative Galvin.
Thank you. And first I have a question of you, Chair Foster. Is it okay to ask about the fiscal note?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, we can fire away.
Okay, thank you. So I imagine this might be I'm not sure who is going to answer this, whether it's Deputy Commissioner or the Director, but I'm looking at what is intended to be produced based on this fiscal note, which I am looking at as analyzing satellite-based remote sensing data, contracting for airborne thermal imagery to identify and prioritize contracting limited light site scale, conducting ground-based geologic mapping and geothermal site investigations, and collecting water samples from geothermal springs, all of which helps to bring data to the forefront. I guess my question is, it seems as though these are things that the private industry would invest in if they wanted this to happen, through the chair. This seems to me that we're putting in a lot of front money on and work on that. So just want to hear your thoughts on that, if you would, through the chair.
Yeah, Representative Galvin, through the chair, John Crother, Deputy Commissioner here. I think in very short summary, we view this like many other resource industries. You know, in mining, we devote a significant amount of money to general geologic information about where minerals could be located, and then kind of pass the baton to industry when there's, you know, this particular area is high copper mineralization, so do further exploration that the industry bears the cost of. And the program that we're setting up here for geothermal would be very similar in the sense of we're characterizing, even through things like field samples, where geothermal resources may be, hoping to take it to the kind of granularity step that then industry would take over and say, we've assessed these different variables and we think these are the right three places to drill wells. These are the right three places to kind of do further in-depth characterization. And so it is, we think it's very hard for industry to take that first initial step because they don't have a lot of interest in investigating in broad kind of regional area-wide areas. They want a secure license to 10,000 acres, 50,000 acres, in this case, maybe even 100,000 acres, and focus on that area. We want to kind of identify which block should they focus on. So that's how we conceive of it.
Thank you. So through the chair, my recollection is typically industry does things like LIDAR and other things. This is for oil and gas, and maybe because this is a new type of energy, then we have to look at this differently and invest differently. And if that's so, I appreciate that. And my other question was, what I thought this would be, the fiscal note, through the chair, is I expected to see things like we'll be processing permits and leases, we'll have oversight of the safety and the plans of operation, we'll make sure that there's public input and do all of that sort of work, ensure that there is investment that they've promised, things like that. And instead, what I'm seeing is, and maybe that's because this is brand new, we're going to we're going to front end much of the work on doing what I would consider maybe exploration. And so I just wanted to hear your kind of big, broad statement on that so that I can be better informed as to why this looks so different than I expected.
Representative Galvin, through the chair, very much understand the question. and I don't think we clearly stated in there, but you know, the department has significant capacity to manage subsurface resources today, mm-hmm. and that's why we don't see a lot of additional costs for this program, because the expertise we have can you know, do geothermal and geothermal leasing and geothermal land management with those same staff that we have that are doing hydrocarbon and other subsurface management. So,
thank you.
Okay. So on the queue, I've got Representative Hannah Josephson Edgman. I'm wondering if I think there's going to be we've already started talking about the fiscal impacts and maybe just to make sure that we're covering our bases, just in case there's anything out there that should probably be covered now that we've started the conversation. I'm wondering, Ms. Weirden and Mr. Huber, are you prepared to speak to both fiscal notes? Ms. Weirden first.
For the record, Melanie Weirden, Director of DGGS, happy to answer any questions.
Okay, and maybe can you do the standard walk us through the whole thing, just so that we've got a good public process and putting it on the record for anyone who might be watching.
Okay. Although mentioned briefly, we'll just go through it here. On slide 6, the details of what we propose to do are on there, and this is information that we will be supplying to identify, you know, take broad areas of Alaska and identify favorable areas for geothermal. And we will be supplying this information to the DNR's geothermal leasing program to help them identify lease areas that would be favorable for industry to work under. And it's to attract explorers and developers to Alaska. The work we propose to do is analyzing satellite-based remote sensing thermal data, similar to what the Alaska Volcano Observatory does to look for elevated heat, and that may indicate favorable areas for geothermal springs in the areas around them. There are airborne thermal imagery systems that then we could fly over these areas to further identify geothermal sites that are promising. Then once you've done that, airborne geophysical techniques, we have experience, for example, up at Pilgrim Hot Springs, where both airborne and ground-based geophysical surveys help us identify where the controlling faults for these systems are located. And then we send field crews there to map out what's known and investigate them. And then water samples can tell you a lot about the subsurface temperature. And so because the water in these systems interacts with the rocks, and it can tell us, essentially we can tell what the potential for the system to produce energy is. And once you put all of this data together, and we publish everything we do, put it right out on our website so that it's all publicly available as soon as we can get it through quality control checks. And then, you know, our goal is then to also look for opportunities for right now the Department of Energy and other federal agencies have grant opportunities out there, and we would also be seeking matched funds for enhancing the capabilities of understanding geothermal energy potential in Alaska by leveraging those funds as well. And then in our initiatives are complementary but don't overlap. We have this very practical, here's the data that people need to come here. But our efforts are complementary to those of the university federal, native, and private sector partners that have different roles in environmental and social government and educational components and public outreach and so, you know, our efforts are that basic fundamental data that everybody, you know, the land managers or the industry needs to help them make decisions.
Thank you, Ms. Weirden. So just for the record, that's OMB component 1031. It is for fund source $1 million. And then the operating at expenditures, personal services, 400,000, travel, 10,000, services, 550,000, and commodities, 40,000. Do you have a quick question? I see that you've got two full-time positions listed, but then if you go to the detail on page 2, it shows 400,000, but three positions as a permanent full-time geologist, 4 at range 21, Fairbanks or Anchorage, permanent full-time geologist 3, that's range 19 in Fairbanks or Anchorage, and then a third position here, permanent full-time GIS analyst. So that shows three positions, but the front page shows two positions. Just wondering if somebody could, Mr. D.C. Crowther, if you could address that.
Yeah, Chair Foster, John Crowther for the record, thank you for the good summary there. Two of those positions are new, and one of them is currently within the department, but it would be funded through the funds brought in through the fiscal note. So great. Two new positions, three in the program.
Thank you very much. Do we have any questions on OMB component 1031? I don't see any. And Mr. Huber, I see you've got a zero fiscal note. If you could just walk us through that just to be official. It's OMB component 3269. Mr. Huber, if you're online, if you could put yourself on the record. And actually, I do not see him online, so...
Chair Foster, I believe Mr. Davies from the AOGCC is online in the place of Mr. Huber.
Oh, great. Okay. Mr. Steve Davies, if you're online, if you could put yourself on the record, and if you are prepared to speak to it, otherwise we can come back to it at our next meeting. Mr. Davies?
Yes, Chair Foster. My name is Steve Davies. I'm a senior petroleum geologist here at the Commission. Commissioner Hugh was having technical difficulties connecting. So I'm not certain about the fiscal end of this. I'm a technical person myself, so we'll make note of this, and Commissioner Hugh can... or the commission will address that at the next hearing.
Okay, thank you very much. Okay, so I think we're good there, and we'll go back to our lineup, which is Representative Hannum, Josephson, and Edgman. Representative Hannum.
Thank you, Chair Foster. I want to go to Section 3, the preferential rights portion that's being struck, and I want to understand right now if... a surface right owner, property owner... I understand the investment concern. What's it look like if a commercial enterprise does come in, does that give them some lease or access to my surface right if they find a developable resource? Or do they have to access from state land subsurface to the resource? So they get some access when they come to explore. So I guess I want to understand what that looks like. And then if they find a commercially viable resource to develop, does that give them any ongoing access to the surface owner via a lease obligation?
D.C. Crowther?
Yeah, Representative Hannum through the chair. The short answer is the subsurface estate is the dominant estate under law, and so the right to access subsurface resources accrues. If an entity has a geothermal lease, they have the right to enter the surface as necessary to develop those resources. Now, they do not have an unfettered right to interrupt surface activities or to disturb surface owner. They, in almost all cases, which we see in oil and gas, they work cooperatively with the surface owner to come to mutual agreements about how and where the surface is accessed. And because of that, it's very often that the surface is only accessed from places where there is an agreement in place. The department has existing regulations to set bonds to prevent unreasonable interference in the event that there's not a reconciliation between the surface owner and that subsurface resource owner. So there's a process in place to address those concerns if it gets to that. And the nature of in practice has been that it very rarely has.
One follow-up. Mm-hmm. So through the chair, in theory, how far from the surface access, you know, because again, with an oil and gas, we kind of have an understanding of what the surface access looks like. And the technology has allowed us to have all the sort of infrastructure besides the access point and a line fairly far removed from that access point. In geothermo, it's sort of all shown as very concentrated footprint. So I'm looking to see whether, if they were successful in finding the commercial lease, you get to put your drill, your pump, your processing on my land, whether I want it or not, because you have a commercial lease that allows you access to the superior subsurface mineral estate.
Representative Hannon, through the chair, if I understand the question right, it's our general understanding today that geothermal wells are typically vertical wells and the associated surface facilities can include power generation. Now, in the event that that private surface ownership was separate than the state subsurface ownership, the where that line was demarcated would have to be negotiated between all the entities, including the state, moderating through this. I referenced those provisions to set bonds for surface interference. And the subsurface owner doesn't have the right to unreasonably interfere without compensation for the surface owner. So they would have to avoid that interference or compensate for the impacts of it. But they would have the right ultimately to site the facilities if it was necessary to develop the resource.
Okay. And then one on a separate note, through the chair, since Chena Hot Springs got mentioned, and we're all kind of familiar with them, but I assume by the bill as it's changing, they're exempted from this because they're not selling any production of their power. They're just generating themselves. It looks like it's under that non-commercial or small-scale industrial use. Yeah. So they're just...
Yeah, Representative Hannon, through the chair, it's our understanding that the geothermal resource, both the surface and subsurface, are a private resource. And so they don't need state rights of access for their own resource development. Now, in the scenario where there was a private, or where there was a public resource like Chena Hot Springs developed on state land, depending on what the precise use of, it may require a lease under this legislation, which we think is appropriate. But this particular bill would not affect Chena Hot Springs ongoing operations at all.
Right. One follow-up, and I guess it's the technical. And is it because of they own the subsurface rights, or it's a surface access point, and so they're not having to drill for it?
Representative Hannon, through the chair, it's our understanding that both the subsurface and surface is privately owned for that development.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you.
Okay. I've got Representative Josephson, Edgman, and Cologne. Representative Josephson.
Chair, I have two questions. The first was related to the same section, Section 3. And I'm curious about this deletion of statute. The statute, 3805381, it looks like it was written in 1971, 72, 74, 80, and then most recently in 2010. And I'm just curious how, given this discussion about the overriding interest of the subsurface leaseholder, how is it that this section, Section A, ever got into law? I mean, for decades, this has been in the books, and is it just that we're deciding we're proposing to make the change now before there's much contest or dispute over ownership interests? In other words, I doubt there's a lot of private property owned on Mount Spur. I have no knowledge of that. Is it to get in before there's a dispute?
So, Mr. Clifton? Yes, through the chair, Representative Josephson. This is, for the record, this is Sean Clifton. The broad explanation for how that got into the statutes is a lot of Alaska statutes were copied and pasted from old federal laws. And we, you know, because the state's history is
and the statutes under particularly under 3805-180 for oil and gas, those have been revised a lot. They've been revised very often from lessons learned from oil development, because there's been a lot of it and there's been a laser focus on it. Geothermal, on the other hand, the state's geothermal resources have never been produced as far as we know. And there just hasn't been that much activity in the industry, at least as far as the state's resources go. So we haven't had a reason to focus on it and refine it and modernize it. Other jurisdictions, particularly like Utah, Nevada, places where they've had a lot of geothermal over the years, they have been updating their statutes and regulations. And so that's why we looked to other states with more experience when we were sampling what we thought would work best for Alaska in our unique situation as a resource owner state.
My second question, I'm remembering that I actually went with the co-chairman, Representative Edgman, to Unalaska. I think it was in late July or early August, principally on a mission related to, I think, a Trident seafood plant. But we took an ancillary trip to the site near the Makushin development. And recently, in the last few months, I've read that notwithstanding lots of effort and disruption to the land, that the community of Dutch Harbor on Alaska has decided this isn't something they presently want to continue to invest in. And so it was absolutely a geothermal resource designed to produce cheap energy for plants, seafood plants, and the community, I guess. What, if anything, can we learn about obstacles there that might help us with this bill? Or is it just one of one story that is going to be unrelated to anything else?
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, this is Sean Clifton for the record. I don't know the details of the saga of the Makushin development. I know a lot of people have been involved in that. It's a private resource owned by the Native Corporation, and I understood that they had some challenges with some federal permitting involved with that. I know that Bernie Carl, who was involved in that project for a time, actually gave a presentation that was largely speaking about that project last year. I believe that was before the Senate Resources Committee. If you wanted to get his perspective on it, that's on the record. But I think to get more details on that and why the community decided to pull the plug on that project after so much time and effort and investment in it, I think you would have to talk to some of the people who are directly involved in that.
Sure. Thank you.
Okay. And we'll take the last two questions here. This is just the introductory hearing, but I did want to at least give 45 minutes for the next bill that we have up today. So next we'll go to Representative Edgman and then Cologne. Representative Edgman.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. My first question is, $1 million fiscal note, the three positions that would come on board would be built into the base of the budget, right? As they say, permanent positions. Is that correct?
Representative Edgman, that's correct.
And I'm not going to object to that, but it's just looking at the opportunities that might lie around the state, having some familiarity with the Makushin project, with a failed project in Naknek, the amount of money that it costs to take a helicopter from Anchorage over Mount Spur, and everything's got to be done remotely. This is the most speculative of all of the renewable energy opportunities out there. It has to be by magnitude of order, perhaps in some instances, solar, wind, hydro, whatever. The ability to assess this resource is extremely difficult. You have to drill, right, to get down to know whether you've got those fluids that are going to come up and turn a turbine and create the power. So Again, I'm not going to fight the fiscal notes, but there's almost a case to be made that this doesn't have to be $1 million year in and year out. And given the difficulties we're having bringing highly skilled technical employees on anywhere, any of the agencies, you know, perhaps Deputy Commissioner, you may want to respond or rebut or, you know, reaffirm whatever. But the opportunities for geothermal power around Alaska exist, but enough to make it commercialized and provide power and to make it a going entity, pretty speculative. I mean, and the number of volcanoes that are like federal lands or the permitting that's involved, this, that, and the other, there's a reason Speaker Harris sitting in the audience here, his bill, House Bill 152 back in 2008 that created the Renewable Energy Grant Fund, that this bill hasn't really been before in the legislature, and I'm editorializing greatly now. But I'm not trying to, I'm sure, be dismissive of the efforts. I think this is a good bill. I definitely support it. I think we should go out and take a look at it. But I almost have to sit back and wonder if the data from airborne thermal imagery and remote sensing and whatnot actually would lend itself more to oil and gas than would geothermal in the very end, the very grand scheme of things.
Representative Edgman, John Crowther, Deputy Commissioner here for the record. I guess there's just a couple additional frameworks that the department views these things through that I would want to share in response to that. The first is that the ability to gather information, subtle surface characteristics, you know, different magnetic surveys, which we do very actively within the division for minerals, that this program is about attuning some of those increasingly huge data capacity gathering for geothermal. So less about $1 million to try and drill one well in one location, and much more to collect general information, which we have increasing capacities to do. And then I'd also note that the, you know, geothermal power, both from its potential applications with, you know, it's now suddenly valuable to have a huge amount of power in a remote location if you can power, you know, advanced fuels generation, different computing processes. Now there's other transmission. There's a lot in the commercial development plans for those. But that's bringing interest into geothermal power, is that the value of that kind of locality where 20, 50 years ago, there wasn't that market for that energy. And then secondarily, geothermal technology, the ability to efficiently manage fluids, the lower temperature geothermal, those are all advancing as well. And so that's why we think this legislation and the program through DGGS allow the state to open up information that will help those kind of advances be applied in Alaska. So we think there's a lot of prospectivity here. It's not a, we're not trying to say this is a better renewable resource, or, you know, Project X is going to be online quicker than X, Y, or Z solar wind project. But we think long term this could be a huge energy resource for Alaska, and has a lot of, there's a lot of benefits from attracting and getting the new commercial interest in geothermal that we're seeing around the country and world focused on Alaska.
Oh,
tongue in cheek, those very words have been said about the gas line too. But I appreciate the bill. I support it. I think it's a good thing. But there's room to be, cautious about things.
Okay, and we're going to go to Representative Cologne next.
Thank you, Co-Chair Foster. So, through the chair, I'm not sure who could answer this, but my question is surrounding slide 4. In the gray box on slide 4, it says, however, only very localized areas will have all the ingredients for cost-effective geothermal energy use. So I'm wondering, what are the ingredients that make it cost-effective? And two, how do we know there's only very localized areas? Is that a guess, or do we know that for sure?
Yeah, Representative Colum, John Crowther, Deputy Commissioner here. The reference criteria, and apology for lack of clarity on slide 3, those 5 criteria kind of all must be present, and they go towards geologic features like the geothermal gradient and market features like the customers. The conversation with Representative Edgman was just touching on the reality that historically, you know, and that statement in the gray box kind of references the historical reason we haven't seen a lot of activity in geothermal Alaska. And the impetus of this bill is that concept is still true, but all 5 of these criteria, we think both the context is shifting, and if we are able to make our terms more competitive, gather more information, we can improve things like surface access, things like identifying where that geothermal gradient is, identifying the porosity and permeability from general geologic features. And so that this will help make that, right now that gray box statement is true, we want to disprove it, I guess is one overly narrative way of saying it.
Okay, follow-up?
Follow-up.
Thank you for that. That clarifies it. That connects those two for me. I just had a short question about the fiscal note. So it sounds like there's $1 million in the governor's budget. Also, this bill has a fiscal note. Or is it that you need $1 million and that's it? Or would you need $2 million? You need it, the $1 million in the governor's budget, plus if this bill passes, you get another $1 million? Or is it just the one per year?
Representative Cullum, through the chair, I'm not a OMB financial ledge finance wizard on these topics. I believe our fiscal note now reflects the governor's budget as a sole item, and so that $1 million is the total amount. So the fiscal note is matches the proposed budget. So there would not be a $2 million, one from each.
Okay, yeah. Great. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Cullum. And when if the bill were to pass and you had the $1 million in both the budget and the bill, in conference committee, the conferees could square it up. So it wouldn't be a doubling up if that was all they needed. So we could fix that. Okay, great. Any closing comments, DC Crother, before we move on to the next bill, or Mr. Clifton?
I would just thank the committee for the time, and it's a very exciting space that, you know, the department's trying to be very forward-leaning and expansive in some of these new spaces, and we think geothermal is a very exciting one.
Sean Clifton, for the record. I know we kind of blitzed through the bill and really glossed over quite a few components of it, and we got a lot of really interesting questions about components of the bill. And encourage you to reach out to us as you continue to think about the bill. And we've got a lot prepared to answer your questions and look forward to doing that.
Great. Thank you very much. Appreciate it. And just for the committee, the plan is to try to hear all of the energy bills. I know some are more relevant to the here and now on the Cook Inlet front, and the gas shortage that's over the horizon there, but we do want to try to at least get everything on out there for now so that the committee can kind of have a very holistic view of, you know, how we're approaching this and know what all the options are. So with that, thank you very much. And next up, we will go to House Bill 388. That is the Cook Inlet Reserve Based Lending Bill. And I'd like to ask Representative McKay and his staff, Trevor Jepson, to please come to the table and put yourselves on the record. And also online from ADA, we have Brandon Vershevsky, the Deputy Director, as well as Mark Davis, ADA's Special Counsel, available for questions. And so with that, we'll kick it off with the presentation. Representative McKay.
Okay, thank you, Chair Foster, very much. Members of the House Finance Committee, it's our privilege to be before you today. We know that there's kind of a traffic jam here at the end of the session to get all the bills heard, and we appreciate you hearing this bill today. To kind of give you an introduction before I read the sponsor statement, House Bill 388 is another bill in our portfolio of bills that we've designed to help encourage a more gas production in Cook Inlet. You already know the situation in Cook Inlet with it being a remote and basically closed market with a limited production market of 70 BCF per year and no ability to import LNG until possibly 2030. So in our view, there are things that can be done to bridge the gap. And this is one of them. So what House Bill 388 basically does is provides a mechanism to lend money to operators in Cook Inlet who may not have the financial resources to set new platforms and drill new wells in existing fields and new fields that are proven proven gas fields. For example, Cosmopolitan and Kitchen Lights. So this bill would help through going through ADA, would provide a lending mechanism. And, of course, it would be up to this legislature or a future legislature to appropriate money. This just sets up the framework for that to happen. So there's no commitment to money or funding in this bill. So I would like to read the sponsor statement, and then we can do the presentation and keep you on schedule today.
Thank
you. So based on the projected shortage of Cook Inlet gas production in both the near future and years to come, South Central Alaska risks becoming reliant on imported LNG. This dependency not only threatens to destabilize our energy prices, but also to erode the economic foundations of our state, impacting every Alaskan in one way or another. House Bill 388 is a potential solution to this problem and is designed to bolster our state's energy independence and economic stability by leveraging gas that is in the ground but not currently being developed. Reserve-based lending is an asset-based financing mechanism in the oil and gas industry in which loans are made based on either undeveloped or developed and producing oil and gas assets. The amount of the loan is based on the value of the borrower's oil and gas reserves. This bill proposes the establishment of a Cook Inlet reserve-based lending fund to support increased oil and gas production in Cook Inlet, ensuring that we continue to prioritize local production over expected costly LNG imports. Recognizing the challenges of attracting private capital to Cook Inlet gas plays, HB 388 proposes a solution to finance projects essential for enhancing affordable gas production for Alaskans. This innovative funding mechanism will not only help avoid the potential economic impacts associated with importing LNG, but also ensure a more secure and self-reliant energy future for Alaskans. By making prudent, interest-aligned loans against oil and gas reserves, the state can catalyze critical infrastructure developments, thereby safeguarding and expanding Cook Inlet's contribution to our energy supply. I urge my colleagues of the 33rd Legislature and the people of Alaska to support HB 388 as a step towards energy development, economic resilience, and the long-term prosperity of our great state. So, Mr. Chairman, I'll now turn it over with your permission to my staff, Trevor Jepson, who will give the presentation.
Great. Thank you very much, Mr. Jepson.
For the record, Trevor Jepson, staff to Representative McKay. Thank you, Co-Chair Foster and the rest of the House Finance Committee for being here today to hear this introductory bill presentation for HB 388, Cook Inlet Reserve-Based Lending. As this committee and the legislature as a whole is aware, a projected Cook Inlet gas shortage in both the near-term and long-term threatens the energy security of South Central Alaska with a potential shortfall as early as 27, which is projected to steadily increase through 2040. The July 2023 public opinion poll conducted by Dittman Research, which was discussed in more in depth at a previous House Finance Committee hearing, South Central residents showed a very high level of opposition to importing liquefied natural gas and a high level of support for financial incentives for oil and gas companies to find and produce more gas from Cook Inlet. Many reliable stakeholders in the state, such as NSTAR and the Alaska Energy Authority, expect LNG imports to be significantly more expensive than locally produced gas. To avoid the potential economic impacts of rapidly increasing energy prices and take public opinion into account, the legislature owes it to Alaskan residents to try and find solutions to increase Cook Inlet gas exploration, production, and development. Figure 1 shows projected fuel costs of coal, natural gas, LNG, and diesel for the next 16 years and was put together by the Alaska Energy Authority. Once again, these are just projections, and no one actually knows what the price to the consumer will end up being. However, simply hoping the price for LNG will come in at roughly the same price as Cook Inlet gas when we're being told otherwise by a variety of legitimate sources, and not taking any other action does not appear to be in the wishes and is not in the best interest of Alaskans. HB 388, Cook Inlet Reserve-Based Lending, represents a potential avenue for the state to be proactive in investing and the development of Cook Inlet gas reserves for the benefits of Alaskans, where private sector capital has not been secured due to project economics in what is a highly competitive global market. The petroleum industry in general faces a complex global environment, challenging the limits of exploration and development amidst fluctuating market prices and factors. Financial institutions in this domain are increasingly confronted with limitations related to capital, counterparty risks, and geopolitical factors, necessitating collaboration with entities that can mitigate a portion of these risks, including local governments that are stakeholders in certain oil and gas projects and oil and gas development. One of the primary issues we deal with in Cook Inlet regarding development is attracting private capital for proven and highly probable reserves. Cook Inlet is a stranded gas market with a cap on demand, which is a large disincentive for both exploration, which is the riskiest phase of oil and gas plays, and for capital-intensive development of known reserves. If you can only sell so much gas a year, no matter how much you produce, your potential rate of return on your investment can be slashed dramatically due to the time value of money, and thus projects can become uneconomical when compared to competing projects. Reserve-based lending represents a financing mechanism tailored for independent oil and gas companies. Independent oil and gas companies are companies only engaged in upstream activities, that's exploration and production. Reserve-based lending is a borrowing-based form of credits where the loan amount is determined by the estimated net present value of cash flows from the hydrocarbon asset. The repayment of the loan comes from the revenue generated by selling the oil and gas from the assets. Characterized by its dynamic nature, reserve-based lending's value is periodically adjusted to reflect shifts in underlying assumptions such as production volumes, market prices for oil and gas, evaluation of reserves, taxation, and other market conditions. Reserve-based lending serves multiple purposes, including financing acquisitions, funding project development, and enhancing production levels of currently producing assets. RBL is a well-established financing mechanism that originated in the United States banking sector and subsequently expanded to the North Sea and globally. Reserve-based lending market is essentially segmented into two primary regions, the U.S. market, which is serviced by North American banks, and the international market, with hubs in London and Paris. Primary distinction between the two markets is the ownership of oil and gas reserves. In the U.S., companies can own the reserves underground, allowing for mortgages on both the fields and the reserves themselves. In contrast, in the international market, oil and gas firms are granted licenses to extract and sell the reserves without owning them, as the reserves belong to the sovereign. Due to the nature of Alaska's constitution, reserve-based lending financing structures in our state would resemble the international market structure due to the mineral rights belonging to the people in the state and oil and gas companies leasing oil and gas plays for extraction. While rates of return would naturally be lower if the state were to invest in these projects than if done by the private sector, we would be weighing that rate of return versus the potential economic effects on our state and ratepayers of significantly higher and unstable energy prices. It's also important to note that state-funded reserve-based lending doesn't need to be for the full amount of every project. In many cases, a reserve-based loan serves as one of multiple financing mechanisms. In other words, if, for example, a development project in Cook Inlet required a new platform, which would be in the hundreds of millions of dollars, it's likely the state wouldn't need to fully fund it, but just be one partner in funding a portion of the based on the asset's proven reserves. When we discuss reserves, we should clarify that not all reserves are the same. There are both different classifications of reserves and different methods of classification. The deterministic method of reserve classification involves calculating reserves based on known geology, technology, and economic conditions. Despite the reality of dynamic and unknown variables, this method uses a single set of values that represent a best estimate for each parameter, such as reservoir size and recovery factor, to name a few. In order to estimate reserves leading to a specified quantity. This is the most common way of reserve classification as it's straightforward and easy to digest for non-specialists. So when using the deterministic method, you're going to get one value for each of the different classifications, P1, P2, P3. The second method of reserve classification is the probabilistic method, which estimates reserves by acknowledging and explicitly incorporating the uncertainty in key parameters into the calculation. The result is a range of estimated reserves at different levels of probability based off the probability distributions used for the calculation. This method provides a more comprehensive view of the uncertainty and risk associated with reserves and enables decision makers to have a better grasp on the range of outcomes to make more informed decisions. The best way to think of reserve classification is by using a combination of these two methods, proved or P1 reserves under the deterministic method, roughly correlate to P90 reserves under the probabilistic method, which means that there is a 90% chance that the reserves are the P1 value or greater, and only a 10% chance that the reserves are less. Likewise, probable or P2 reserves correlate to P50, and possible or P3 reserves correlate to P10. A state-funded reserve-based lending program should focus on proven reserves to maximize the benefit to Alaskans and minimize the risk of state funds. HB 388 explicitly makes that distinction. So in closing, HB 388 sets up a Cook Inlet Reserve-Based Lending Fund under ADA. It conforms the dividend policy that ADA has with other funds. It does not specify an appropriation. It simply creates the fund and allows the legislature flexibility to direct funds to certain projects. The bill also introduces a reporting requirement for ADA. So ADA would be required, if this bill passed, to go out and actively evaluate potential Cook Inlet reserve-based lending projects, and then they would bring a report back to the legislature at the beginning of next session. And finally, funds may be used for reserve-based loans deemed necessary to increase oil and gas production from the Cook Inlet sedimentary basin, and the bill would allow ADA to issue loans lower than that they normally would based on their rates of return. So it would allow them to fund some of those projects that the private sector is not being attracted to currently. Yeah. Thank you, Co-Chair Foster.
Okay, thank you very much. We've got questions. We'll go to Representative Stapp and then Representative Hannon.
Okay, thank you, Co-Chair Foster. I'll have a few, I think, and I'll probably come back for more through the chair to Representative McKay or Mr. Jepson. Okay, so my first question is simplify the process here. So basically, we are going to capitalize, let companies take out a loan on an asset we own, i.e. the state's oil and gas reserve, capitalize that against us giving them money, so when they produce the gas, they'll sell it back to us. Is that a fair assessment?
For the record, Trevor Jepson, staff to Representative McKay, they would be receiving the loan based on the value of the produced asset. So it wouldn't be the full value of the asset because they don't own it. But there would be revenue and profit associated with them extracting that asset. And that would be how the loan values would be calculated.
So, follow up, Mr. Co-Chair. Mm-hmm. So through the chair to Mr. Jepson, who owns the asset? Does the state of Alaska own the asset of the oil and gas?
For the record, Trevor Jepson, staff to Representative McKay. Representative staff through the chair, that is correct. The state does own the asset, which is why the lending structure would look more like the international market lending structure. So.
Follow up, Mr. Kutcher, and then I'm going to go to ADA after this. But so if I go to North Rim Bank and I ask them to give me a loan using their Anchorage asset as collateralization on my loan, and then whatever my business model is, I'll pay it back to them. Do you think I should expect to get that loan from North Rim Bank using their own business office in Anchorage as collateral?
Representative Staff, to the chair, it's not an apples to oranges, it's kind of an apples to oranges comparison here, because there is significant capital that's associated with extracting the reserves, and that's what the loan would be based upon. And there's a significant value to the state because the state cannot extract those reserves. We don't have an oil and gas company, so it's necessary for a third party to be there to conduct that activity to bring those revenues to the state.
So follow up, Mr. Co-Chair, then we'll go to Mr. Virginsky. Through the chair to Mr. Jepson or Representative McKay. So we give them the money to develop our gas and they go bankrupt. What happens to our money?
Representative Stapp, through the chair, as with all loans, there is a level of risk associated with it. And the financial due diligence to write these loans correctly would be up to the discretion of ADA.
Can I Mr. Chairman, this McCabe. Is Representative McCabe. Wow. I think I could shed some light on a couple of these questions. First of all, Representative Stapp is getting one step ahead of House Bill 388. House Bill 388 doesn't authorize lending money to anybody. It just sets up the framework where you could do it someday under another piece of legislation. If a company goes bankrupt producing oil and gas, you still have the assets, you still have the platform, probably a rig, and you still have the assets that are in the ground. So what would likely happen is another operator would take over and assume the loan more or less and continue to make those payments. The loan payments are made from the sale of the gas that the operator would produce. Another thing about this bill that I think I should emphasize is if you look at these four bullets on the screen right now, there's absolutely no risk whatsoever to the state with House Bill 388. What House Bill 388 does, it enables ADA to go out and look at what the situation is in Cook Inlet officially and come back to the state with potentially recommended projects with economics. So my recommendation is take a hard look at this bill. If you pass it, you can find out what you have in the inlet, and then you can decide whether or not if you want to go forward. So this is more or less kind of like a evaluation program to find out. You know, there's, of course, everybody has an opinion, but I think for the state to actually go out and have professionals evaluate the inlet for what projects might be eligible for this program, then you know what you have, and you know all the facts, and you can decide later to not do anything or to go forward. So I think that's important to mention. Thank you, Mr.
Yeah.
Chair.
Yeah. Thank you, Representative McKay. With your permission, Chair, I'd like to ask the ADA representatives a couple of questions through the chair.
Sure, Representative Stapp.
Mr. Brzezinski, I hear you on the line. This is Rep. Stapp. So my first question is, does ADA currently have any debt or bonds issued to, let's say, Blue Crest or Fury?
For the record, Brandon Brzezinski, Deputy Director, ADA. Through the chair, Representative Stapp. We do currently have a loan with Blue Crest. I believe the outstanding balance is $13 million.
Follow-up, Mr. Kutcher.
Follow-up.
So ADA has already given a producer a $13 million loan, probably more than that. You said the outstanding balance. What was the purpose of that loan, Mr. Brzezinski?
Through the chair, Representative Stapp, the purpose of that loan was to finance the rig and the man camp for Blue Crest.
And follow up.
Chairman, may I help?
Mr. Representative McKay.
Okay, Representative Stapp, through the chair, that rig that you're referring to drilled several wells at Cosmopolitan. They're oil wells, and they're currently producing today. So that investment is providing some return to the state of Alaska. I think it's important to note that. There wasn't a situation where you had no return whatsoever. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Yeah. Thank you, Representative McKay. For the record, the point is ADA is already giving these companies investment money. So I'm asking the ADA representative chair as the purpose of the underlying bill. So Mr. Brzezinski, Brian, is there anything that currently prevents ADA from issuing more loans to these producers if they so choose to do so in order for them to facilitate oil and gas or gas development at Cook Inlet, other than your guys' own board and policy?
Through the chair, Representative Stapp, ADA has the ability to provide loans and finance efforts in the Cook Inlet, and we have. I mean, aside from Blue Crest, we gave a loan to Hex, which they repaid early for $7.5 million. ADA has a history with jackup rigs. With Mr. Davis on the line, he was involved in that one from several years ago, so he could elaborate more on that if the committee wishes. But you know, I think for this bill, the clarity in statute's always better. It's a good thing. And just, you know, even though we could finance projects in the Cook Inlet and we could structure or size our debt using like a reserves-based model. We appreciate the clarity.
Okay, one
Mr.
last.
Chairman, can I add one more comment?
Okay.
I think it's very important for the committee to understand that at Cosmopolitan, there are actually two different fields. There's an oil field and a gas field, and they're separate. The gas field lies on top of the oil field. The rig that ADA provided money for was an onshore rig to drill the oil reservoir, which is deeper than the gas reservoir. What we're focused on here is the gas reservoir, which could require a platform, a completely different project, could be the same operator, but a completely different project scope than what's being referred to previously. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Stamp.
Yeah, thank you, Co-Chair Foster. Through the chair, again, one last one for the ADA folks. So when you give companies loans, what type of asset evaluation do you do to know that they're going to be able to pay you back? Do you take into account the potential sale of potential production? Do you actually look at the company's balance sheet before you give them money?
Through the chair, representative staff, all of the above. There's an extensive due diligence process, and we'll hire contractors, consultants if necessary to review the assets. We have a robust review of the fiscal model of the company, and several presentations in front of ADA staff, going through our investment committee, as well as like going through our board. So, all of the above, sir.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Okay, so next up we've got questions, and so I think it was Representative Hannon, then Josephson. Representative Hannon.
Thank you, Chair Foster. You'll be relieved to know that Representative Staff asked the bulk of my questions having to do with, right now, ADA can already make loans in Cook Inlet and has done so. On the slide that's up there now, the second bullet, I'm wanting to make sure I'm understanding. The way it's phrased, you're only talking about the dividend created, because it says giving the legislature to fund directed projects, or is this bill somehow giving us more authority to give direction internal to ADA's decision-making of what projects would they loan to or not?
For the record, Trevor Jepson, staff to Representative McKay. So one of the most important parts of the bill, we believe, is this reporting requirement that's going to actively require ADA to go out and review different Cook Inlet reserve-based lending projects. That is not currently in statute, and nothing currently requires them to do so. So once they evaluate those projects, and they'll come up with the bill currently states a cost estimate for the project, potential recoverable gas, and the amount necessary to be appropriated to the fund. So that bullet point is addressing the fact that the fund is created, allowing the legislature flexibility to fund those projects that they present to the legislature. So there would be a report given to the Senate and the House, and they come forward, and ADA would say, if requested by the Finance Committee or a Resource Committee, they'd come forward and they would present these projects that they've analyzed, and they would return the potential dollar amount, potential gas amount, the cost estimate for it.
So follow up. So this would, through the chair, this would create in law something very different than any other ADA-funded project, because the legislature, I actually hear from people fairly consistently about wanting to have more, why don't you, the legislature, direct projects within ADA? My understanding is that we don't get to decide which loans they make or don't make. But you're saying this legislation is creating a flexibility through a reporting of analysis for these RBL projects that we, the legislature, would say fund Project A but not Project Z.
Representative Hannon, through the chair, that is correct. If they want to put one of the projects in the budget and pass both bodies, then that's how we envision the process to work. And
through the chair.
Representative Hannon.
Would it limit this RBL projects could only go through that process, or is there does the traditional way of ADA lending to Blue Crest without having ever come before us and asked for any evaluation, they can still do that? Or through this RBL projects, only those that are in the report that the legislature then says loan them the money?
Yeah, Representative Hannon, through the chair, it does not replace the current mechanisms that they have to make those reserve-based loans. And the reason why we felt the reporting requirement necessary and to give the legislature the oversight approval is because most of these projects, ADA isn't making the loans because they wouldn't. It doesn't reach the financial or the fiduciary responsibility that they owe because the rates of return aren't high enough. So that's why they come to the legislature and they'd say, hey, this only has a 2 or 3% rate of return. We wouldn't do this fund because it doesn't meet our fiduciary requirement. But if the legislature thinks that the project is that important to the state, they can choose to capitalize that project.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, Representative Josephson.
Through the chair. Mr. Jepson, correct? I'm remembering something I think that Representative Staff said on the floor about how historically ADA's returns have only been in the 3% range anyway. And so I'm just pondering how that relates to ADA's seeking our permission where projects would be perhaps less than 3%. But I guess my question really, Mr. Chairman, is for Mr. Brzezinski, if I've said his name correctly. In the bullet point, and I know you're not the author of the bullet point, Mr. Brzezinski, but it talks about the fund coming from outside ADA's revolving fund. And so when I hear the term revolving fund, that's just sort of money in, money out. Am I right about that? This is no different than any bank or credit union where you loan money and then you monthly get money coming in. Is that what's meant by revolving fund?
For the record, Brandon Brzezinski, Deputy Director, ADA, through the chair, Representative Josephson. That is correct. The revolving fund is in reference to like ADA's, like all of our money, our fund, so all of our fund.
Follow up?
Am I right, Mr. Brzezinski, that ADA has unencumbered monies in the hundreds of millions of dollars?
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, ADA does have some cash positions. However, like ADA also has we have a project pipeline that, you know, there's things in the queue for which about it's in the range of about $400 to $500 million of potential projects. Some of which we can, you know, we have talked about publicly in our board meetings. Like for instance, most recently we're looking at the Alyeskan methanol plant up on the North Slope. Some of the projects aren't quite there yet, but soon to come. And we're under NDA, so I can't elaborate much further than that. But yes, it is correct. However, the monies are accounted for.
All right. I think I'm nearly there, Mr. Chairman. So essentially, follow up through the chair, the unencumbered resources, now some portion of them under this bill. So if we think of it as a pie, there'd be some sliver of that pie that would now be presumably encumbered by the RBL in this bill. Is that your understanding?
Can you repeat the question, Representative Gustafson?
Sure. The impact of this bill would be that some of the unencumbered dollars or cash position that ADA has would shrink to some degree, maybe not substantially, for purposes of Cook Inlet reserve-based lending. Is that your...
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, that would only be if our board decided to move money into this fund, which we would not do unless there was a loan that was going to be made. But if the legislature were to appropriate general fund monies to the fund, then that money would, as the bill reads, would be designated only for these type reserves-based loans. So, but as far as like ADA's receipts go, we would have to have an active like application, active loan before us, and we would move the money over, and then that money obviously would be lent out and therefore encumbered.
Okay, just last follow-up. Just to be clear, and I haven't had time to study this bill the way it needs, but if the legislature approved a recommended RBL, it would be ADA dollars that would fund, that would represent the RBL, not general fund. correct?
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, I suppose it could be either or if the legislature were to appropriate monies to the fund for a loan. I mean, that the likelihood of ADA offering a loan that is like below market market interest rates, that's the path you'd likely have to take in order for that to occur. But as far as like ADA's receipts go and us lending our money at a rate below interest rates, you know, it'd have to pass the board. You know, ADA, the board, we're all subject to the state's investment and finance policies, prudent investor rule. So we have some limitations there. However, like in the past, you know, the legislature has appropriated money to ADA for IGU, for the Interior Gas Utility, Fairbanks Gas Trucking Project. So that was at a lower than market rate, but we were legislatively directed to do so.
Okay, that's helpful. Thank you.
Okay, Representative Stout.
Yeah, thank you, Co-Chair Foster. Through the chair to Brett McKay or Mr. Jepson. So we're going to have a private company collateralize our asset. We are going to lend our money to that company in the concept of, I guess, what, net present cash value, where they're going to pay us back and sales to us. So what mechanism do we have to limit that company's project, limit that company's profit margin, right? Because they're using our asset, collateralizing that with our money, and then selling it back to us. So do we have any mechanism to limit how much money they can make off that system?
Representative McKay?
Yeah, through the chair, Representative Stapp, they would not sell the product to the state. They would sell the gas to utilities, and then they would pay back the loan from the revenues from those sales. So that rate, that sales price of that gas is regulated by the RCA. So your question, I think, infers that there could be like a windfall profit situation, but I doubt that could happen because the RCA carefully regulates the price of gas that's produced in Cook Inlet and sold to the utilities.
Yeah, Mr. Co-Chair. Yeah, through the chair, Representative McKay. Yeah, no, thank you for mentioning the price controls that through the RCA, because, again, my point's always going to be, again, we're trying to design another system where now we collateralize our own asset, put our own money in. But really, the problem with the demand is at the end user point of sale, is it not? I mean, if the price for the end user, i.e. the utilities, paid more money for gas, that would make the economics of this project more valuable to the producers, would it not, if they had a higher profit margin?
Well, I don't know, through the chair, Representative Stapp, I'm not sure I can predict future gas prices in Cook Inlet, but I think what we're trying to do, and I think what we're pretty confident of, is that gas produced in Cook Inlet using our own people and our own rigs and our own equipment and our own resource will be cheaper than importing LNG from foreign countries. So that's where we're going. What I would like to say here, you've seen several bills that we've put forward. Two of them are for royalty relief. We had a jackup rig credit bill that came through, and then, of course, the free seismic. What we're trying to do is, if the royalty relief bills don't incentivize more activity to produce more gas in the inlet, then this is another step that we could take without standing up an Alaska oil and gas company, which, you know, at some point, that's where you're getting to. If nobody's interested in drilling for gas in Cook Inlet in the private sector, then you're left with the public sector having to do it. So we're just trying to design bills that still leave the work and the operation and the professional expertise needed to the private sector while we're assisting them with the financial part. And I can't emphasize it enough that 388, this bill, does not commit any funds today. It just says, let's go find out, let's let the professionals design programs in Cook Inlet, like setting new platforms. For example, you could set two new platforms at Kitchen Lights and a new platform at Cosmopolitan and probably fill that gas decline problem for 20 years. Now, I can't promise that sitting here, but I think that HB 388 gives you a vehicle where you could find out that answer with professional expertise, and then you will know well, maybe we should invest $50 million in a new platform at Cosmopolitan or Kitchen Lights. And a new platform could be $200 to $300, $400 million. The state doesn't need to invest all of that. It may be enough to invest, you know, 25% of it. And then the private sector would do the rest. So I'm just trying to, I hope I'm helping you get an idea of where we're going with this. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, for the moment.
Representative Stapp.
Yeah, I think Co-Chair Foster through the chair to represent the case. So on that kind of thought, I mean, why not just have the state go out and buy a jack-up rig? Didn't we do that once?
For the record, Trevor Jepson, staff to represent the case. Yes, we did. Ada purchased the Endeavor rig, and that's actually a good follow-up here to what Representative McKay just said, and not having to fund the totality of projects. That rig was roughly $140 million, and the state's portion of funding that I believe was roughly $20 million. And I would defer to Mark Davis, General Counsel, to Ada to confirm that.
Mr. Davis?
Yeah, this, for the record, this is Mr. Davis. I'm counsel with Ada. The jack-up rig was approximately $141 million, and Ada put in $23 million, and we made a return on our investment.
Fault, Mr. Kutcher? Follow-up. Thanks, Mr. Davis. What happened to that jack-up rig?
It was moved to South Africa because one of our partners had an opportunity to move it there, and therefore they bought the rig from us. But in the meantime, we had drilled several holes that were abatement hole, which helped the inlet, and also we were able to determine that some of the areas did not have oil and gas reserves, which is pertinent to this bill because, you know, reserve-based lending is going to create a borrowing base rather than recourse-based lending.
And last fall, Mr. Kutcher, could we get it back from South Africa through the chair?
We'd have to buy it back. There is another jack-up rig in the inlet, and Ada is well aware of how it's being used. We've been in discussions concerning that rig.
Thank you.
Yeah, through the chair, if I may follow up, Representative Foster, I don't know. This is my opinion. Typically not advisable to go out and buy large marine drilling pieces of equipment. There's significant liability, and I would recommend that we'd rather have the private sector handle that part of it. What do you think? Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Okay, seeing no further questions, this was an introductory hearing on this, so we'll go ahead and set it aside for now. Thank you very much, Representative McKay. And
thank you, committee, and thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. And so our next scheduled House Finance Committee meeting is Monday, April 22nd at 9 a.m. And at that meeting, we'll hear HB 116, which is Restorative Justice Appropriations. We've heard that bill before. And also HB 134, which is Repeal Education Tax Credits. That's the sunset, renewing the sunset. And then also HB 45, which is PFD Contributions to the General Fund. That's Representative Prox's bill. And so with that, the afternoon meeting on Monday, we'll be hearing SB 187. That is the capital budget and fiscal update presentation from the Legislative Finance Division. So if there's nothing else to come before the committee, we'll be adjourned at 3:28 p.m. Thank you.